His final years were marred by a schism in his organization. It began with a dispute over copyrights. Adamski accused C.A. Honey of publishing, under Honey's own name, ideas and materials stolen from Adamski. The two men split. Co-workers sided with one or the other, and everything began to fall apart. Even Luzinstag, appalled by his descent into mysticism, broke with Adamski. Yet she felt beholden to him. I can still call him friend. Never in my life can I forget that the Tibetan masters themselves, say Adamski's critics, were borrowed from theosophy, via one or another of its offshoots that flourished in Southern California during the 30s. Theosophy was an influential mystical movement founded by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, 1831-1891. A trance medium and occultist, Madame Blavatsky claimed to be in contact with the ascended masters, advanced beings with powers such as telepathy and astral projection. Based in Tibet, yet traveling widely, to other planes, other planets, and Blavatsky's apartment in New York, they manifest themselves to specially favored individuals. The masters that appeared to Blavatsky were a wisdom-speaking pair named Kuthumi and Moria, the predecessors, say those critics, of Firkin and his friends. Like Adamski, the cigar-smoking Madame Blavatsky, whom the Society for Psychical Research called one of the most accomplished, ingenious, and interesting impostors of history, was reviled by many as a charlatan, and revered by others as a spiritual teacher. Thrill and the happiness his books and former letters brought into my life. He continued to travel and lecture, to meet with followers who had remained loyal, and to dwell on Mount Palomar. Over Mount Palomar, on cloudless nights, hovered the moon. A pale orb that astronomers scrutinized, that coyotes yapped, that owls hunted by. And that George Adamski, who had sailed around it, gazed at dreamily and nostalgically. In 1965, while in Washington, D.C., for a lecture, Adamski died. He was buried, as an ex-soldier, in Arlington National Cemetery. Who was this man? What sort of man was George Adamski? Did he truly travel on a flying saucer and meet with the space people? Was he a contactee, or a con man? In her introduction to Inside the Spaceships, Charlotte Blodgett, its ghostwriter, admits that the book will elicit incredulity in varying degrees. Some will believe Adamski, she says, others will see him as the victim of delusions or the perpetrator of a hoax. But she knows her own mind in the matter. She has met the man, and found him to be of unquestionable integrity. Blodgett goes on to describe Adamski. He is handsome, kind, patient. That patience, she says, must have influenced his selection by the space people. He is well balanced and approachable. He has a sense of humor. And he is a man of wisdom, whose lack of formal education has left him free of the fetters which too often shackle the academic mind. Others who knew him have added to this portrait. Luzinstag reports that his manners were impeccable, that he was the perfect gentleman in his relations with women, that he was at once quick-witted and naive. But the quality she found most remarkable was his ability to play down his own courage and dedication. Instead, he came on as a light-hearted fellow, sprinkling his conversation with expressions such as "to hell with it" or "what the devil." Desmond Leslie tells us that Adamski was physically strong, with burning black eyes. He was a down-to-earth sort, and, beneath his public persona of a talkative, colorful celebrity, a great human being. William Sherwood, a ufologist who met with Adamski on several occasions, praises his integrity. He describes, in a letter reprinted in Zinstag's book, how Adamski had been offered money to repudiate his photos and claims, but had turned it down. The money had been offered, speculates Sherwood, by business interests opposed to the low-cost sources of energy that the space people might reveal to us. Sherwood sums him up as a self-taught, many-sided man of destiny, a visionary who faced courageously the ridicule and antagonism that came his way. And Bryant and Helen Reeve, that retired couple who visited contactees, found him to be a sincere and unruffled man. They were taken with Adamski's winning smile, and found his answers to their questions to be sensible and convincing. He is truly an extraordinary individual, they concluded, a man of many contrasts, many moods, many ideas, and many experiences, different, so different. For many who knew him, then, Adamski was almost a noble figure. Yet even his admirers could admit that the man of destiny was not perfect. Sherwood noted that the pressures to which he was subject caused him to make mistakes, though never to become dishonest. And Major Hans Petersen, the Danish Air Force officer who organized the lectures in Copenhagen, saw the entire man. George Adamski was a remarkable person. He owned nothing, had no money, not in a bank. Without being slovenly, he dressed as he wished, even at high-level parties. He swore, he liked to drink, he made love with any woman who approached him and whom he liked, and they were not few. And at the same time, we find a man who entertains deep veneration of the Creator, of nature and of his fellow man and for the cosmic laws in a degree, which one normally does not see on this planet. UFO Contact, Spring 1980. Reprinted in Zinstag. Even Lou Zinstag recognized the ambiguities in the man, realizing there was probably another story to his story. She mentions his skill at evading direct questions, and tells of a conversation that added to the somewhat oppressive image of a mystery man and kept me at a distance for the rest of our friendship. So we are left with a mystery man, a down-to-earth sage and high-minded emissary of the space people, with an unknown side to him. Yet for me who heard about him, George Adamski was no mystery at all. In the view of those who scoffed at flying saucers, and of me who believed in them, he was clearly a fraud, a humbug, a rascal. His claims of having met the space people were preposterous. His detractors were amazed that such nonsense was given the slightest attention, much less credence. Seeking to discredit him, they accused Adamski of all manner of sins and disreputable activities. Major Petersen has listed some of the calumnies leveled against him: dishwasher, hot dog seller, restaurant keeper, religious fanatic, drunkard, illegal alcohol distiller, liar, rich author, and much more is, what his enemies have called him, every word a lie. Petersen also raises the question of Adamski's photos. He tells how those astounding images of spacecraft were maligned by skeptics, labeled as blatant fakes. Not true, says Petersen. The photos were genuine. And certainly, the issue is central. If the photos are genuine, Adamski must be telling the truth about flying saucers. If they are fake, doubt is cast upon his entire story. So what about them? What are we to make of those photographs of spaceships? Desmond Leslie called them the most priceless pictures of all time. William Sherwood compared Adamski's zeal in attaining the photos with that of the most dedicated of scientists. And Beth Marley, a special effects cinematographer, said that if the photos were fake, they were the most con. The bootlegging accusation came from a visitor to Palmer Gardens, who claimed that Adamski had confessed, during a drinking spree, to having started the Royal Order of Tibet as a front for making wine during Prohibition. Vincing trick photography he had ever seen. To have faked them, said Marley, to have gotten the shadows right, would have required expensive equipment that Adamski did not possess. But others were not so sure. The famous shot of the scout ship, see page 66, was scrutinized by the British UFO Society. Their verdict? A model, fashioned from the lid of a soda machine. Other analysts saw the lid of a beer cooler, of a chicken brooder, of a tobacco humidor. But clearly a lid. Adamski dismissed these attacks. Everyone was free, he allowed in inside the spaceships, to judge his photos and his stories, but a skeptic's personal conclusion in no way alters the fact of their reality. The average mind, he noted, always finds it easier to scoff at new wonders than to face the fact of its own limited knowledge of the miracles that await discovery in the unlimited universe in which he dwells. The attacks on Adamski were not limited, of course, to his claims. His character, too, was denounced. He was labeled a crackpot, a confidence man, a self-styled professor of Oriental philosophy. But the most common disparagement, and the one that served to discredit him most in the eyes of the public, was that George Adamski was the mere proprietor of a hamburger stand. Now it was no secret that he was closely connected with the Palermo Gardens Cafe. For years Adamski had held court there, holding informal discussions with guests and lecturing in the evenings. He once described to Luzinstak how he had sold refreshments, and performed other menial tasks, at the cafe. And she was dismayed to learn that such employment had harmed his reputation in America. Why would a democratic people, she wondered, find problematical a humble background? But it was an aspersion Adamski did not allow to go unchallenged. On one occasion a UFO investigator had described him as someone who ran a hamburger stand on the road to the Mount Palomar Observatory, and who kept his telescope on the roof of the stand, all of which showed him to be a rude, untutored fellow, sniffed the investigator, scarcely to be taken seriously as a student of the cosmos. An indignant Adamski responded to their charge, in Flying Saucers Farewell. First of all, he pointed out, the Palermo Gardens Cafe was not a hamburger stand. It was a full-scale restaurant that had been mentioned in Holiday magazine. Indeed, many notable visitors had dined there and signed the guest register. Secondly, he neither owned nor worked at the cafe, he simply lived on the property, and spent time in the restaurant conversing with guests. Thirdly, his telescope was not kept on the roof, but under a dome in a nearby clearing. And even if he were a hamburger vendor, what would be wrong with that? America had been built upon little fellows who made good. And a final charge that has been leveled against him involves a novel Adamski wrote and self-published in 1949, 4 years before his first, alleged, ride on a saucer. Pioneers of Space, A Trip to the Moon, Mars, and Venus is a work of fiction about a voyage by rocket ship. Encountered on the planets are high-minded humans, living in utopian societies. Their philosophy and customs resemble those of the space people who would appear and inside the spaceships. For Adamski's detractors the novel was the smoking gun, proof of his humbuery. He had simply rewritten it as a factual account. So who was George Adamski? The question would seem to have only two possible answers. He was either the real thing, or an egregious fraud. He was either a genuine contactee, who met with the space people, or a cynical fake. A gullah of the gullible. A charlatan who was in it, and had been ever since his royal order of Tibet days, for the money, women, and fame. One of these, and one only, was the real Adamski. No middle, surely the example of a self-taught sage, employed in a restaurant and holding forth there, is worthy of respect. Do we look down upon Socrates for having earned his living as a stonemason? For having taught in the marketplace of Athens? For having pondered the deepest matters with a mind, like Adamski's, unfettered by academic shackles? Copies of Pioneers of Space are hard to find. The Library of Congress has one. Examining it, I wondered if I were not peeking behind the scenes, gazing into the hidden effects of a literary conjurer. Ground was possible. As Desmond Leslie said, he must either be accepted in toto or completely rejected. Yet isn't it conceivable that Adamski was neither a completely sincere individual nor an utterly venal one? That he was some curious combination of the two? According to this view, he started out as a genuine street philosopher, one of those working-class intellectuals who used to haunt public libraries, lecture from soap boxes, hold forth in taverns. But a streak of mischief, or daring, had impelled him to dramatize his teachings, by embroidering them with fantasy. His initial attempt at this had resulted in the royal order and the Tibetan masters with whom he claimed to have studied. Then, as Flying Saucers captured the public imagination, he had simply updated his imagery. Such concoctions were justified if they helped to convey the vital truths about nuclear peril, the brotherhood of man, the perfidy of the ego, that he saw it as his task to teach. It was a question of pragmatism. As for the money and other benefits that his books had earned him, what was wrong with those? If delivering an urgent message brought you worldly success, the more power to you. Success was no sin. So what's the verdict? Was George Adamski a purveyor of truth or a perpetrator of fraud? Or some outrageous combination of both? It is a question the reader must decide for himself. As Adamski put it in Inside the Spaceships, "At all times I have felt very humble for the privilege which has been granted me to listen to their words of wisdom and to visit and travel in their beautiful ships. All that they have asked of me is that I pass their knowledge on to my fellow man, whoever and wherever he may be. This I shall do." Writing to a student in 1951, Adamski speaks of the book he is currently working on. "Its purpose is to alert earthly men to the manifesting of the universe as it is now being revealed to him through the presence of saucers and spaceships in our own atmosphere. It will be all fiction but based on fact and might open up the minds of earthly men, whereas nothing else probably would ever be able to do so." Quoted in Zinstag. "Leaving to each man the privilege of believing or disbelieving, of benefiting from a higher knowledge or casting it aside in derision and skepticism." Yamsky George Adamski died on April 23, 1965, in a suburb of Washington, D.C., and there his tale might be expected to end. But it has an epilogue. On the following day, an Englishman named Arthur Bryant was walking in the Devonshire moors, when a flying saucer appeared, out of thin air, he would insist, and landed near him. Three men hopped out. Two were tall. Interested readers may obtain copies of Adamski's books from the Adamski Foundation, P.O. Box 1722, Vista, California 92085. With high foreheads. The third was of normal height and features, and introduced himself with a name that sounded like Yamsky. The three seemed to glow. They chatted with Bryant, explaining that the ship was from Venus, and took him aboard briefly. Then they flew off into the sky. Bryant reported the incident to ufologists, who were quick to discern its connection with Adamski. He also told them of his discovery of a glass phial that the space people had left behind. Inside it was a piece of paper, with an inscription in classical Greek, "Adelphos Adelpho," brother to brother. And on that enigmatic note concludes the tale of George Adamski, messenger of the space people. 4. Let me out to hear. Different types thus far we have encountered, but one type of extraterrestrial, the space people. Yet as Winfield S. Brownell, author of UFOs, Key to Earth's Destiny, Legion of Light Publications, 1980, has pointed out, there are infinite variations in types of ships, planets or other sources of origin, characteristics of the occupants, frequency of vibration or the dimension on which they operate, and other variables. In other words, a variety of intelligent beings have been visiting the Earth. These beings come to us from around the universe, and they can differ from one another in every respect, physically, psychologically, and culturally. For convenience sake, they may be divided into two categories, human and humanoid. Let's examine these different types, so you'll know what to expect, depending on which of them you get involved with. In the human category are the space people, the extraterrestrials described by Adamski and other contactees. Again, the name is one of convenience. Space people come from a wide range of planets and cultures, and can differ from one another in significant ways. However, they share the following characteristics. 1. Physically, they resemble us, with a tendency towards a robust, Scandinavian look. 2. They live by a set of moral precepts called universal or cosmic law. 3. They are missionaries, bringing universal law and cosmic consciousness to less advanced planets such as our own. The space people are usually portrayed as supremely wise and benevolent, notes Robert Schaffer in his skeptical but otherwise astute The UFO Verdict, Prometheus Books, 1981, urging mankind to end all wars, abolish poverty, distrust, and atomic energy, adopt socialism, and live in perfect harmony. 4. They are vegetarians. 5. They wear jumpsuits. For some 50 years now, this high-minded race has been contacting us. They have been landing their saucers, welcoming aboard a select few, and sharing their nectar and wisdom. But the space people have enjoyed no exclusive access to the Earth, no unique sphere of influence. During the same period, our planet has been visited by another type of extraterrestrial, the humanoids. These are beings that resemble us in general form, yet are clearly not human. The first humanoids to receive extensive publicity were the little men. Encountered mostly in France during the 50s, they were described as short, man-like creatures in diving suits. Their features, obscured by helmets, were said to be alien. The little men would learn their sources, venture outside, and, a la Jacques Cousteau, conduct scientific surveys of flora, fauna, and terrain. Their contact with humans was usually accidental and brief. Having no desire to communicate, they avoided us, scampering back to their ship when spotted. For nearly a decade, France was beset with these pint-sized explorers from the sky. Yet the little men were not the only humanoids being Eric von Daniken, the archaeologist, believes they visited the Earth in prehistoric times as well, inspiring our myths of gods and goddesses. Why all these visitors began to arrive at this point in history is a matter of conjecture. Perhaps our radio signals, rockets, or nuclear explosions attracted their attention. Or it could be that only recently has the Earth become accessible to space travelers, explained Rama Kahlo, an extraterrestrial who spoke through transmedium Mark Probert in 1946. The Earth is now sending forth a strong ray or column of light, and this makes it easier of approach from other planets. The little men became the little green men of popular parlance. But they were never green. Ufologist Leonard Stringfield examined 1,500 reports of flying saucer occupants, looking for little green men. Of the handful he found, all were either extraterrestrials who reflected green light emanating from their craft, or else hoaxes. Sighted, in locations around the world. A bizarre assortment of space travelers seem to have chosen the Earth as their destination. They ranged from ape-like creatures with eyes that glowed, a kind of interplanetary Bigfoot, to zany little fellows with party horns for noses. So the humanoids vary considerably in physical type. But a trait that is shared by most of them, and that further distinguishes them from the space people, is a lack of missionary impulse. As researcher Isabel Davis has pointed out, in her article Meet the Extraterrestrial in Fantastic Universe, November 1957, they utter no lofty messages, no explanations of ancient riddles, no admonitions, warnings, reassurances, prophecies, or esoteric doctrine. Instead, the humanoids seem content to scare, astound, or study us. Rarely will they seek to communicate, or to interact in a meaningful manner. Thus, their reasons for visiting the Earth remain obscure. Except, that is, for one race among them. A race whose purpose has been all too clear. The space aliens. Who are the space aliens? Their homeland, philosophy, and customs remain unknown. We are not even sure what dimension they come from. Abundant testimony, however, is available as to their appearance. Like the little men, they are said to be short and humanoid. But the resemblance ends. For the space aliens, who wear no helmets, have large, bear-shaped heads. Their eyes are big and black, while the rest of their features, slits for nose and ears, a tiny mouth, seem to be vestigial. Have they evolved into a weird race of observers? Their faces are expressionless, prompting one investigator to refer to them as inscrutable, bug-eyed creatures. Thin and wiry, with smooth gray skin, they tend to wear tight-fitting uniforms. Like cartoon characters, they have only four digits on each hand. Their speech has been variously described as consisting of growls, grunts, buzzes, cackles, or hums. But what distinguishes them most from other extraterrestrials is their behavior. For the space aliens abduct people. The abduction phenomenon on a night in September 1961, Barney and Betty Hill were driving through the mountains of New Hampshire, when they spotted a bright object in the sky. As they continued along the highway, the object seemed to be following them. Finally, they stopped and examined it with binoculars. A flying saucer. And discernible in the windows, they insist, were humanoid figures peering at them. In a panic, the Hills drove off into the night. Unable now to see the saucer, they were sure it was directly above them. They heard a beeping sound, and began to feel tingly and drowsy. The next thing they knew, they were still driving along the road, but miles further on. They arrived home at daybreak, 2 hours later than expected. It was as if those hours were missing. During the weeks that followed, Betty Hill had dreams of being aboard the saucer. Her husband, meanwhile, was feeling anxiety and having nightmares. They submitted to cross-examination by investigators from a UFO organization, who noted those missing hours and the inexplicable scuff marks that had appeared on Barney's shoes. Betty had begun to worry that her dreams might relate to something that had actually happened. Finally, they went to see a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist decided to hypnotize the Hills and regress them in time, in search of a traumatic event. Each was put into a trance. And when taken back to that night in September, each recalled an incredible sequence of events. The flying saucer had landed. And its occupants, short, bald, bug-eyed creatures, had blocked the road, removed the couple from their car, and taken them into the saucer. In the part we entered, reported Betty from her trance, there was a curved corridor that appeared to go around the craft on the inside. The Hills had been led along this corridor, into rooms illuminated with a bluish light. That they had been laid out on tables, the surface, Betty recalled, had been hard and smooth and cold, and subjected to medical examinations. Barney had kept his eyes closed during most of the encounter. Betty, less frightened, had examined a star map and conversed with one of their captors. I said to him that this had been quite an experience. They had then been returned to their car, with memory blocks that blotted out the events of the last 2 hours. The space aliens had arrived, and performed their first abduction. Several more abductions took place during the 60s, most notably that of Betty Andreessen, a housewife in Massachusetts. On a wintry night in 1967, a group of space aliens entered her home, by passing through a closed door. They were clad in uniforms with eagle insignias, and led by a tall one named Quasga. The aliens floated her into their ship, parked in the backyard, subjected her to a medical exam, and took her on a journey to another worldly realm. She was then returned to her home. Andreessen, too, was given a memory block, and would remember little of her experience, until years later, when hypnotically regressed. The Hills' tale is recounted in The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller, Dial Press, 1966. Ray Palmer was a prophet of the abduction phenomenon, too. 15 years before the arrival of the space aliens, he and Shaver had published Earth Slaves to Space. It was a fictionalized account of spaceships that landed, abducted humans, and spirited them away to other planets. A memorable, though forgotten, feature of her abduction was that visit to another worldly realm. Two space aliens in hoods had taken her into a passageway, a long tunnel lit only by the aliens themselves, who glowed in the dark. Gliding along in silence, they passed through a mirror and entered an eerie landscape of sea, mist, and distant city. As they approached a dazzling light, a giant bird appeared. The bird was engulfed by fire, until only a pile of ashes remained. During the 70s, sporadic cases of abduction were reported. The most publicized was that of Travis Walton, snatched while working with a woodcutting crew in a national forest. But it was not until the 80s that the phenomenon moved into full swing. Suddenly, hundreds of Americans were being kidnapped by space aliens. As the cases accumulated, a standard scenario emerged. A person would be lying in bed, or driving along a lonely road. Without warning, space aliens appear. They paralyze the hapless individual and float him up to their ship. There he is laid out on a table and medically examined, by a team of aliens with a tall one in charge. The abductee may then be given a tour of the ship, a visit to another world, or a message, often relating to abuse of the environment. Finally, he is returned to his bed, or car with a memory block to suppress any recollection of his experience. Worm-like creature crawled from the ashes. And Andreessen heard a voice call out her name. An American housewife had encountered the phoenix, the mystic bird of ancient Egypt. According to legend, Once every 500 years, the phoenix flew to the Temple of the Sun in Heliopolis, where it consumed itself in fire. A worm would then emerge from the ashes and grow into a new phoenix.